Welcome to the reading of the Mason City Global Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. It is Monday, December the 4th, and my name is Doug Kretzinger, and here is our first story on the Mason City Globe Gazette. Headline is Trump DeSantis Hold Dueling Rallies. It's about the Iowa caucus. And it reads, written by Thomas Beaumont and Michelle L. Price of the Associated Press. Ron DeSantis completed his campaign promise to visit each of Iowa's 99 counties, crossing a symbolic but also tactical threshold by telling his audience in a central Iowa town, "This should show you that I consider myself a servant, not a ruler." Former President Donald Trump, who still remains far ahead of DeSantis, mocked him at a larger rally about 100 miles away on Saturday and said the Florida governor's campaign was falling like a very seriously wounded bird. In that way, the Florida governor's moment, which much like the months of campaigning so far, took place under Trump's towering shadow. The presence of Trump on DeSantis' day of accomplishment underscores the challenge he and other Trump rivals face in Iowa. DeSantis has said he expects to win the caucuses. He focused much of his campaign on the state and a super PAC supporting him, has invested more than $16 million in advertising and more on building a campaign organization for the January 15 caucuses. But even with the endorsement of Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, DeSantis has not cut into Trump's huge lead and is facing new pressure from the campaign of former United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley. His political operation lost another top official on Saturday. Kristen Davison resigned from the Never Back Down super PAC less than 2 weeks after taking over from the previous CEO following his departure, according to two people familiar with the matter who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss internal operations. Politico first reported Davison's departure. Never Back Down super spokesperson Jess Szymanski said that Scott Wagner would serve as the new CEO and that the group still has the most organized advanced caucus operation of anyone in the 2024 primary field. DeSantis portrayed the time-worn feat for presidential candidates of visiting all of Iowa's counties as an adventure for his family. On one visit, he went to the Field of Dreams baseball movie set and pitched to his children on a baseball diamond cut into a cornfield. Stops at famous bakeries and ice cream parlors made for quaint stories about his family, including wife and three young children, trekking across Iowa since May. But the mission taught him more, he said. "You meet people, rustle up some votes," he said at an events center in Jasper County, just east of Des Moines in central Iowa. "But is it just all about politics?" Well, Trump has savaged DeSantis, mostly criticizing him as disloyal for running against Trump after seeking his endorsement when DeSantis first ran for governor. "We hit him very hard, and he's been falling out of the air like a very seriously wounded bird," Trump said during his Cedar Rapids event, twirling his right index finger to symbolize what he says was DeSantis's fall. DeSantis advisors argue that making stops in each county on Iowa's sprawling checkerboard can squeeze critical support out of small rural counties while also demonstrating a commitment to courting all parts of the state. But he is facing internal problems within his political operation, with two key officials leaving the major super PAC supporting him and a challenge from Haley as the chief competitor to Trump. She has been rising in early state polls and picked up the support of Americans for Prosperity, the political arm of the powerful Koch network. Over the year, many Iowa Republicans have said that they continue to support Trump and what they see as his accomplishments, notably the nomination of three Supreme Court justices who voted to overturn Roe v. Wade and abolish a federally guaranteed right to abortion. Some Republicans feel Trump has been weakened by the indictments he faces, even if they see the cases as politically motivated. But few in the GOP field have attacked Trump as the centerpiece of their campaigns, driven by a belief that those criticisms can backfire. Nathaniel Gavronsky, a Republican from Wayne County, Iowa, attended Trump's event in Cedar Rapids. Gavronsky said he had met every candidate in the January caucuses and was likely to support North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum. Gavronsky said DeSantis' visit to all 99 counties helped his campaign. But the problem is you can't go there with rhetoric. You have to actually take harder questions. Trump's going to win, he said. If it gets to the point where Trump might not win my caucus, I'll jump ship and make sure Trump gets in there. Our second story on the front page is in the headline, Still No Word If Iowa AG Will Cover Drugs for Rape Victims. Funding for emergency contraception in limbo year after it was paused. It's written by Tom Barton, Globe Gazette, Des Moines Bureau. Nearly a year after pausing payments as part of an audit of victim services administered through the Iowa Attorney General's Office, state funding for emergency contraception for victims of sexual assault and rape remains in limbo. While two counties have said they'd step in to help local victims if necessary, a Central Iowa sexual assault nurse examiner is working with a pharmaceutical company on an agreement to provide the medications to Iowa pharmacies at no cost. Republican Iowa Attorney General Brenna Beard paused the funding as part of an audit of the victim services administered through her office. Beard announced the audit upon taking office last January. Though the payments are not explicitly required by law, it has been the state's long-time practice to cover the cost of emergency contraception from the victim's compensation fund, which comes from fines, fees, and penalties paid by criminals. No taxpayer dollars go into the fund. In rare cases, the fund also has paid for abortions for rape victims. An attorney general's office said in April it was reviewing the practice to use of public funds. The Attorney General's office did not respond to requests for comment and a list of questions submitted by the Gazette on the status of its review. Victim advocates, including the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault and Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, have urged Byrd to continue using the program's funds to cover emergency contraception and abortion. They say cost should never be a barrier for rape victims seeking medical care, including contraception to prevent an unintended pregnancy or abortion. Byrd has not publicly said why she paused reimbursement for those services, and her office has not identified particular concerns. Speaking to the Gazette last month, Byrd said her office was still putting together findings, and we'll be announcing that soon, she said. Asked what spurred the review and what her specific concerns were, Byrd said, when we release the review, we'll go over all of that. But just as a prosecutor, I wanted to make sure that victims' assistance is working well and that we're doing everything that we can do in all of the parts of the state, she said. So that's why we had those roundtable discussions all over Iowa to listen to victims' advocates, prosecutors, and law enforcement about how things are working in their areas. And we uncovered a number of problems and challenges and things could be done for many to make things better. So that's what we're working on with the review, and we'll be releasing that soon. Byrd declined to elaborate as to what issues arose as part of those discussions. We'll put it all out there with what we found at the different roundtables and some of the comments, and also how we're going to be working through some things that we can make victims' assistance better in Iowa, she said. That's why the review has taken a little while. As of this summer, more than 160 reimbursement requests for emergency contraception provided to sexual assault survivors from across the state were pending approval from the Iowa Attorney General's office. According to records obtained by the Gazette, And first reported by Iowa Public Radio, the reimbursement requests from hospitals and pharmacies across the state totaled about $7,000. The vast majority are from this year, but one dates to August of 2020. One is coded as confirmed child abuse. The Attorney General's office has not disclosed how much it previously spent on emergency contraceptives and abortions. It also has not provided an update on the number of requests for reimbursement that have been submitted by providers since the pause in payments went into effect. Counties hold off on funding. The Polk and Johnson County Boards of Supervisors earlier this year authorized funding for emergency contraception and support services for victims of sexual assault and rape as the state program remains in question. Neither county has yet paid for any emergency contraception as pharmacies are either continuing to submit invoices to the Attorney General's office or holding on to them until a final decision is made, according to county officials. The pharmacies that victims most commonly access for emergency contraception have been informed that Polk County will pay invoices should the Attorney General's office ultimately decide to not cover them, said Eric Kuhl, director of Polk County Community, Family and Youth Services, which oversees the county's sexual assault response team. Year to date, the team has responded to 255 reported sexual assaults in Polk County. 99 of those victims requested and received emergency contraception. Since August 8, when the Polk County Board of Supervisors passed a resolution to provide funding for emergency contraception if the Attorney General's office makes a final decision to not reimburse pharmacies, the team has responded to 77 sexual assaults. 31 victims requested and received emergency contraception. We continue to believe it is best for the AG's office to continue the long-standing precedent of providing funds for emergency contraception, and we are hoping, or rather hopeful, that decision will be reached sooner than later, Kuhl said. Continuing this service would provide the most consistency and equity statewide, including for locations where local funding has not yet been committed to doing so. It is also consistent with the long-standing good work of the AG's office to support sexual assault victims. It is not paid for from taxpayer funds. And the goal with emergency contraception is to prevent pregnancy arising from violent sexual assaults, which appears to be widely common ground. Burt has been a vocal opponent of abortion and said the pause has been for reimbursement, for example, to Planned Parenthood for an abortion or for abortion pills, things of that nature. Sexual assault nurse examiners, along with other victim advocates, have emphasized that emergency contraceptives are not abortion pills. The medication delays or prevents ovulation, preventing a pregnancy from occurring, according to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. It has no effect on an existing pregnancy and will not affect implementation, said Katie Rasmussen, who is coordinator for the Johnson County Sexual Assault Response Team. It is a completely different drug than abortion medication, and we do not offer abortion medications to our patients. So far this year, she said the county sexual assault response team responded to at least 80 patients between the ages of 13 and 60 who would have been offered emergency contraception if they met the guidelines. It's been 9 months of waiting for a clear answer on this, and it's really hard to plan for the program in the future and best serve our patients when we're left in limbo, Rasmussen said. I have no knowledge of how this process works or what the audit entails, but I never expected it would take this long. Shannon Knudsen is the coordinator for the sexual assault nurse examiners for Polk and Story counties. Knudsen said she is working with a pharmaceutical company, which she would not name, to develop a statewide voucher program where the company would directly donate medications, including emergency contraception and prescriptions to treat sexually transmitted diseases, to pharmacies who dispense them to victims of sexual assault. We just want to take care of our community and our patients, Knudsen said. I'm hopeful to have a more concrete plan in place for the first part of the year for assistance with pharmaceutical companies. Here's a story from page 3 of the paper. The headline is Report, Surrendering Ukrainian Soldiers Shot Dead, and it's an Associated Press report. And the dateline is Kyiv, Ukraine. Ukrainian officials on Sunday launched an investigation into allegations that Russian forces killed surrendering Ukrainian soldiers, a war crime if confirmed, after grainy footage on social media appeared to show two uniformed men being shot at close range after emerging from a dugout. The video shows the servicemen, one of them with his hands up, walking out at gunpoint and lying down on the ground before Russian troops appear to open fire. It was not immediately possible to verify the video's authenticity or the circumstances in which it was filmed, and it was unclear when the incident took place. The Ukrainian General Prosecutor's Office on Sunday launched a criminal investigation hours after the Ukrainian military's press office said in an online statement that the footage is genuine. The video shows a group in Russian uniforms shooting at point-blank range two unarmed servicemen in the uniform of the armed forces of Ukraine who were surrendering, the prosecutor's office said in a telegram update on Sunday. The Russian Defense Ministry did not immediately respond to an emailed request for comment. As of Sunday evening, there were no public statements from the Russian government or military on the video. Kyiv, its Western allies and international human rights organizations have repeatedly accused Moscow of breaching international humanitarian law since it launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022. The Kremlin denies these allegations. And here are a few shorter stories. The headline on this one is Biden support wanes among Muslims in U.S. Dateline is Chicago. Muslim community leaders from several swing states pledged to withdraw support for U.S. President Joe Biden on Saturday at a conference in suburban Detroit, citing his refusal to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. Democrats in Michigan have warned the White House that Biden's handling of the Israeli-Hamas war could cost him enough support within the Arab American community to sway the outcome of the 2024 presidential election. Leaders from Michigan, Minnesota, Arizona, Wisconsin, Florida, Georgia, Nevada, and Pennsylvania gathered behind a lectern that read, "Abandon Biden, ceasefire now." In Dearborn, Michigan, the city with the largest concentration of Arab Americans in the United States. Former U.S. ambassador accused of aiding Cuba is a headline. Dateline is Miami. A former American diplomat who served as U.S. ambassador to Bolivia has been arrested in a long-running FBI counterintelligence investigation, accused of secretly serving as an agent of Cuba's government, the Associated Press has learned. Manuel Rocha, R-O-C-H-A, 73, was arrested in Miami on Friday on a criminal complaint, and more details about the case are expected to be made public at a court appearance Monday, today, said two people who spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity. And one of the people said the Justice Department case accuses Rocha of working to promote the Cuban government's interest. Federal law requires people doing the political bidding of a foreign government or entity inside the U.S. to register with the Justice Department, which in recent years has stepped up its criminal enforcement of illicit foreign lobbying. And here's a short line about Alaska Airlines. They are, as of Sunday, it agreed to buy Hawaiian Airlines in a $1.9 billion deal, including debt, putting it on track for a potential clash with a Biden administration that has shown wariness about higher fares in the industry. Next story. Florida Republicans, it is headlined. Christian Ziegler, the chair of Florida's Republican Party, says he will not resign over a woman's allegation that he raped her, saying in an email to supporters that he is innocent. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis called for Ziegler to resign. Wrongful death is a headline. Ode Al-Fayoumi, the father of a six-year-old Palestinian-American boy who was fatally stabbed in what authorities allege was a hate crime, filed a wrongful death lawsuit last month against Joseph Gzuba, 71, the suburban Chicago landlord charged in the attack that left his child dead and the boy's mother wounded. Here's a headline about Pope Francis. For a second Sunday, an ailing Pope Francis skipped his popular window appearance to the public in St. Peter's Square, but in televised remarks that said he's doing better, even though his voice wouldn't let him read all his comments aloud. And two more. Here's one climate protest. Thousands of people marched through the center of Brussels, Belgium on Sunday in a boisterous rally highlighting the dangers of climate change. We must save our planet. It's the only one where there's beer, said one sign, read one sign. And finally, earthquake toll. A powerful earthquake that shook the southern Philippines killed at least one villager and injured several others as thousands scrambled out of their homes in panic, officials said Sunday. And we're going to move on to a little sports report here for the moment. College football playoff, it's the heading Michigan, Bama, Washington, Texas set. Florida State left out of the Final Four. It's written by Ralph D. Russo of the Associated Press. The final season of the four-team college football playoff turned out to be the most controversial, with an unprecedented snub. Michigan, Washington, Texas, and Alabama were selected Sunday, and Florida State became the first unbeaten Power Five conference champion to be excluded from the field. Michigan will face Alabama in the Rose Bowl. Washington will play Texas in the Sugar Bowl on January 1, and the winners will meet for the national championship January 8 in Houston. Before the CFP grows to 12 next year, an expansion that was delayed by a year because of infighting among the conference commissioners who manage the postseason system, the selection committee forced the toughest decision in the 10-year history of the format. Florida State is a different team than they were through the first 11 weeks, explained Boo Corrigan, the selection committee chairman who was also the athletic director in North Carolina State, Florida State's Atlantic Coast Conference rival. The Seminoles, 13-0, lost star quarterback Jordan Travis to a season-ending injury 2 weeks ago, but continued to win with a backup and then a third-string quarterback. The committee, though, is instructed to judge teams for what they are heading into the playoff and decided FSU, without Travis, is not among the best four in the country. I am disgusted and infuriated with the committee's decision today to have what was earned on the field taken away because a small group of people decided they knew better than the results of the games. What is the point of playing games? Florida State coach Mike Norvell said. He added, "What happened today goes against everything that is true and right in college football. A team that overcame tremendous adversity and found a way to win doing whatever it took on the field was cheated today. It's a sad day for college football," he said. Travis is a 60-year player whose development into one of the best quarterbacks in college football has fueled Florida State's resurgence over the last 3 years. "Devastated, heartbroken," Travis said on the posted on the social media platform X. "I wish my leg broke earlier in the season so you all could see this team is much more than the quarterback. I thought results matter. 13-0, and this roster matches up across any team in those top four rankings. I am so sorry." Whichever team was left out had a good argument to get in. That created unprecedented controversy, and the committee passed over FSU to pick Alabama, which upset Georgia to win the Southeastern Conference Championship, and Big 12 champion Texas, which beat the Crimson Tide on the road in September. Here's some Today in History information. And today's highlight is December 4 of 1956. Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Carl Perkins gathered for the first and only time for a jam session at Sun Records in Memphis. On this date in 1783, General George Washington bade farewell to his Continental Army officers in a tavern in New York. In 1918, President Woodrow Wilson left Washington on a trip to France to attend the Versailles Peace Conference. In 1942, during World War II, U.S. bombers struck the Italian mainland for the first time in a raid on Naples. In 1965, the United States launched Gemini 7 with Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Frank Borman and Navy Commander James Lovell aboard on a two-week mission. While Gemini 7 was in orbit, its sister ship, Gemini 6A, was launched on December 15 on a one-day mission. The two spacecraft were able to rendezvous within a foot of each other. And in 1978, San Francisco got its first female mayor as city supervisor Dianne Feinstein was named to replace the assassinated George Moscone. In 1980, the bodies of four American churchwomen slain in El Salvador 2 days earlier were unearthed. Five Salvadoran National Guardsmen were later convicted of murdering nuns, Ida Ford, Maura Clark, Dorothy Cazell, and lay worker Jean Donovan. In 1986, both houses of Congress moved to establish special committees to conduct investigations of the Iran-Contra affair. 1992, President George H.W. Bush ordered American troops to lead a mercy mission to Somalia, threatening military action against warlords and gangs who were blocking food for starving millions. In 2000, in a pair of legal setbacks for Al Gore, a Florida state judge refused to overturn George W. Bush's certified victory in Florida, and the U.S. Supreme Court set aside a ruling that had allowed manual recounts. In 2016, a North Carolina man armed with a rifle fired several shots inside Comet Ping Pong, a Washington, D.C. pizzeria, as he attempted to investigate an online conspiracy theory that prominent Democrats were harboring child sex slaves at the restaurant. No one was hurt, and the man surrendered. He was later sentenced to 4 years in prison. And in 2017, President Donald Trump sealed back two sprawling national monuments in Utah. It was the first time in a half century that a president had undone that type of public land protection. And these articles by the Associated Press. Here's a sports article, a short one. LaPorta leads Lions past Saints. Dateline is New Orleans. It's the Associated Press article. Sam LaPorta had career highs of 9 catches for 140 yards, including an early touchdown and a crucial first down snag in the final minutes, and the Detroit Lions defeated the reeling New Orleans Saints 33-28 on Sunday to post their best record through 12 games since 1962. The Saints lost quarterback Derek Carr in the fourth quarter to back, shoulder, and head injuries, and Carr was hurt on a penalized hit by Bruce Irwin, who drove the weight of the body into the quarterback. Jared Goff passed for 213 yards in that game and two TDs for the Lions, who raced to a 3-touchdown lead and then held off a valiant comeback bid by the Saints. New Orleans fell one game behind first-place Atlanta in the league's weakest division, the NFC South. And after falling behind 21-0 in the first quarter, the Saints pulled as close as 24-21 late in the third. Saints also had the ball at midfield with a chance to take the lead in the final 3 minutes, but turned the ball over on downs when Jameis Winston threw behind Chris Olave. You are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we're going to turn to the Fort Dodge Messenger, and they have some stories here on the front page. I'm going to read this one. It's written by Hans Madsen. It's entitled, Many Hands, Light Work, Volunteers Pack Meals for Feed My Starving Children. So it's on the front page of the paper. Shift change at the Feed My Starving Children Mobile Park event Saturday at Community Christian School was a study in efficiency. Each volunteer, already wearing a hairnet, got in line, washed their hands in the hall, donned gloves, then went into the gym to begin working for several hours. The organization will eventually get the packed meals, each containing rice, beans, spices, and vitamins, to areas where food is needed overseas. Al Larson of Fort Dodge was helping with one of the first steps. His job was turning flat boxes into assembled and labeled boxes to hold the meal packs. There's actually a picture of him doing that on the front page here. This and a lot of other things, Larson said of his job. The first shift filled over 180 boxes. And he's been helping for several years. I like to help the kids, he said. It's fun to find out where they send them. I get to smile a second time. Regan Vore, V-O-R-R-I-E, 4 of Thor, was sitting by her mom, Melissa Vore, V-O-R-R-I-E it is, carefully attaching batch labels to the soon-to-be-filled plastic meal pack bags. Her sister, Macy Vore, 6, was also helping out. I think the kids get to learn that there's a time to give back, Melissa Vore said. It's a chance to learn the importance of helping others in need. As a bonus, the day was quality time with her children, and the work was pretty much play. We like the sticker, she said. Cora Peart, P-E-A-R-T, 6 of Fort Dodge, had a very important job. She got to be the quality control inspector for her dad, Josh Peart, as he heat-sealed the filled meal packs. It's an important lesson that we should be helping people. Not everyone has a cupboard full of food, Josh Peart said. We are thankful for what we have, and some of that is time we can give. When the shift first started, Peart was just getting the hang of it. He had met the dreaded learning curve, was heading uphill and had the peak in sight. I hope so, he said. It would help me feel better. Each person who was helping fill the meal packs was responsible for a different ingredient. Lydia Grimm, 7 of Fort Dodge, got to add the powdered vitamins. She nodded yes to several questions. Indeed, adding the vitamins was her favorite task. She also liked helping other kids and the time with her 7-member family. Also a vigorous nod yes. Her mother, Brittany Grimm, spoke on her behalf. This is her second time doing this, Brittany Grimm said. She was very excited for today. After the meals are sealed, they go into boxes. Those in turn get stacked on a pallet for shipping. Jason Ribbons of Tacoma got assigned to help with that. He's got lots of experience in his professional work life. I've done thousands of these, he said, of putting heavy sacks on pallets. For this one time, I said, why not? It's easy to help out. His stacking partner, John Shields of Fort Dodge, while lacking the box stacking on pallets work experience of Ribbons, brought his work ethic along for his fourth time helping out. You just have to be willing to do the work, Shields said. There's a lot of people lacking good nutrition in regular meals. It's an opportunity to provide for people in need, in great need. And for more information, you can save my starving children. For more information, you can go to fmsc.org. And there's pictures here of those folks doing the work we just explained. Here's an article entitled, Maize Brings Realism to Fire Science Students. It's on the front page, State Simulator Used at Iowa Central Community College. Iowa Central Community College fire science students recently had the opportunity to experience various firefighting scenarios using a simulator from the State Fire Marshal's Fire Service Training Bureau. Prepared for attack in full firefighter gear, the students work through various situations they might find themselves facing at a real-life fire scene in the State Mobile Breathing Apparatus Training Unit, MOBAT, M-O-B-A-T. The training unit is a 53-foot semi-trailer with interchangeable walls, floors, ceilings, and various obstructions meant to pose challenges to firefighters. It is basically a 53-foot, three-story, changeable maze, said Lenny Sanders, fire science program coordinator at Iowa Central. There is a control room at the front where we can add smoke, different sounds, or strobe lights to teach disorientating situations. The students spent 3 days in November learning in the trailer, which was also used for training by the Fort Dodge Fire Department. The MOBAT is just one of several hands-on training experiences Iowa Central Fire Science students have throughout the year. Sanders said he works closely with the Training Bureau to bring the most real-life and professional training equipment to Fort Dodge. I've been teaching with the Bureau since 2000, said Sanders. We bring in the same equipment used by the professionals for our students' training. We have our training tower to use, but we like to also bring in interior attack simulators where flames roll over their heads, confined space rescue simulators, and roof trainers. Iowa Central students put in approximately 240 man-hours in the training simulations. I'm moving to the opinion page right now. I'm going to read this article, a couple of them here. It's Messenger editorial, Lights at Kennedy Makes Season Bright. Holiday Extravaganza supports local service groups. And it reads, as Christmas approaches, the campground at John F. Kennedy Memorial Park is once again being transformed into a holiday wonderland. The 20th annual Lights at Kennedy will help make the season more festive for area residents and visitors. And additionally, the event raises money to support local service groups. The light display, featuring multiple different exhibits, debuts Friday night. It'll also be open Saturday and Sunday. In addition to this weekend, the upcoming dates are December 15 through 17 and December 22 through 23. The display will be open from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. on each of those days. Free will donations will be accepted. Some of the donations will support the philanthropic efforts of the event's sponsors, the Fort Dodge Noon Sertoma Club and the Fort Dodge Young Professionals. Backpack Buddies is one of the best known of these efforts. Since 2010, it has filled the backpacks of elementary school-aged children from low-income homes with nutritious food to eat during the weekends. Excuse me. The rest of the donations will be reinvested in the light show itself. The numerous Christmas themed displays that are at the heart of Lights at Kennedy are sponsored by businesses and organizations. This enjoyable outing has become a holiday tradition for many Fort Dodgers. It is a superb adventure that can be enjoyed by the whole family. Along the way, there's a good chance participants will encounter Santa and his many helpers. Each year, there are changes and enhancements to keep the event fresh and exciting. This month is filled with seasonal events that make it a joyous time of year. The Messenger strongly urges readers to include Lights at Kennedy on their hectic holiday agendas. The outstanding displays will help fill you with holiday cheer. And here's another article. This one is written by Randy Feistra. And as you know, probably, he is the Republican from Hull who represents Iowa's 4th Congressional District. And this is entitled, Completing My Third Biannual 36-County Tour. It's on the opinion page. When I was elected to serve Iowa's 4th Congressional District in the U.S. House of Representatives, I promised that I would be a strong voice for our families, farmers, and rural main streets and equally transparent with and accessible to the people I represent. By officially completing my third annual 36-county tour, I have upheld that pledge, had many invaluable discussions with Iowans, and transformed our priorities and values into sound policy and legislative victories. Since I kicked off the first iteration of my 36-county tour in 2021, I have made more than 230 stops at businesses, manufacturers, police departments, farms, schools, universities, hospitals, ethanol plants, and healthcare clinics. I've also held several town halls with Iowans and attended Rotary and Kiwanis Club meetings, to name a few. At every stop, I am inspired by the incredible work that Iowans are doing to support our families, help our neighbors, keep our main streets vibrant, and power our economy. This year alone, I've made 75 different stops on my 36-county tour. In Webster City and Logan, I met with veterans to discuss how we can work together to ensure that our men and women who have served our country receive the benefits and high-quality care that they have earned. That's why I voted to provide veterans exposed to toxic hazards like radiation, burn pits, and Agent Orange with the health care coverage they need to receive life-saving treatment, keep VA hospitals staffed and operational, support at-home care for veterans in need, and find behavioral health resources for our veterans. In Sanborn, Alexander, Ida Grove, Humboldt, Audubon, and Britt, I held town halls with farmers and producers to talk about the importance of a strong farm bill that strengthens crop insurance, helps prevent the spread of foreign animal disease, opens new export part markets, and bans China from buying American farmland. I also met with pork producers in Nevada, dairy farmers in Larchwood, and turkey farmers in Manson. Following these productive conversations, I introduced legislation in Congress to protect Iowa agriculture and strengthen our agricultural economy. My Defend America's Rural Energy Act, which passed the U.S. House of Representatives in March, would ban China from buying American farmland suitable for ethanol and biodiesel production. My Fridge Act would help build refrigeration infrastructure abroad to ship Iowa beef, chicken, turkey, pork, and grains worldwide. And my Crop Insurance for Future Farmers Act would keep Iowa farmland in the hands of Iowa farmers by lowering the cost of crop insurance for the next generation of producers. These are just a few of the agriculture of the These are just a few of the agricultural policies whose inclusion I am advocating for in the Farm Bill. In Sac City, Manning, Sydney, Lawrence, and Spirit Lake, I visited small businesses, which are the backbone of our economy and create good jobs in our rural communities. Serving on the House Ways and Means Committee, I am working to combat inflation and lower costs for our Main Street businesses so that they can keep their doors open and continue to succeed. Similarly, in places like Otobolt, Humboldt, Garner, Estherville, Boone, and Hampton, I had the opportunity to see firsthand the positive impact of domestic manufacturing on our local economies. I will continue to be a staunch advocate for growing our manufacturing industry in Iowa. Bringing our critical supply chains home and promoting pro-growth tax policies that benefit our business and families. I've also participated in many health care meetings across the district in Sioux Center. I welcome Governor Reynolds to tour Sioux Center Health, where we covered the need to expand access to quality, affordable health care for our rural communities. In Council Bluffs, I convened a roundtable with health care professionals at All Care Health Center to discuss our shared support for the 340B program, which helps other prescription drug prices for our families. In Algona, I met with Mercy One Hospital leaders about my commitment to protect Medicare and the importance of telehealth and rural broadband to our communities. Finally, in Council Bluffs, Sioux Center, Sioux City, and Marshalltown, I spoke to members of each respective Chamber of Commerce about our joint work to strengthen our economy, support our small businesses, grow our workforce, and reduce our nearly $34 trillion national debt. We also covered topics such as affordable housing tax credits, fair trade agreements for Iowa agriculture, and reimbursement rates for rural hospitals. I appreciate all that our local chambers of commerce do to promote economic growth and keep our rural communities strong. These stops represent only a small portion of the trips and visits I've made over the last 3 years. Beginning in January, I will kick off my fourth 36-county tour to continue meeting with Iowans, advocating for our priorities in Congress, and deliver for the good people that I am blessed to represent. We are government together, and your thoughts and opinions matter to me. Please contact my office at feenstra.house.gov or by phone at 202-225-4426. If I can ever be of assistance, I am proud to represent our families, farmers, Main Street Businesses and Rural Communities in Congress. Again, that is written by U.S. Representative Randy Feistra, 4th District Congressman. Going to go to the obituary section now. We have three, four, five, six, or seven here. Linda Seinlinger, S-I-N-D-L-I-N-G-E-R, 73, of Fort Dodge, died Saturday, December 2, at her home. Cremation rites will be accorded with Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. A service honoring Linda's life will be at 11 a.m. Thursday, December 7, St. Paul Lutheran Church. Family will greet friends from 9:30 to 10:45 a.m. Thursday, St. Paul Lutheran Church. Memorials may be directed to the discretion of the family. Arrangements have been entrusted to Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Linda is survived by her husband, Leroy, her children, Shane, spouse Allison Sindlinger, Waukee, Tina, spouse Thomas Williamson, Fort Dodge, grandchildren Alex, Lance, and Lucas Williamson, and Chloe, Tegan, Piper, and Afton Sindlinger. She was preceded in death by her infant son, Lance, and her parents, Cecil and Viola Easley, and her brother, Dennis Easley. Linda was a member of St. Paul Lutheran Church. She treasured time spent with her family, especially her grandchildren. James Jim Perkapile, Jr., P-U-R-K-A-P-I-L-E, 81, of Fort Dodge, died Tuesday, November 21, at his home. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, December 9. The historic Bruce Funeral Home, 923 First Avenue South, with Pastor Alaire Willits officiating. Visitation will be from 4 p.m. To 7 p.m. on Friday, December 8, at the historic Bruce Funeral Home. Interment will take place at Memorial Park Cemetery with military honors conducted by the VFW Post 1856 and the U.S. Navy Honor Guard. Memorials may be directed to the family. Arrangements are with historic Bruce Funeral Home of Fort Dodge. Online condolences may be left for the family at brucesfuneralhome.com. He was preceded in death by his parents and his companion of 37 years and love of his life, Judith LeBohm. Marjorie Wooters of Lake City passed away November 17 at the age of 97 in Denver, Colorado, preceded in death by her parents, husband Cecil, sister Dorothy, and grandson Scott, survived by children, Ewayne, spouse Judy of Minnesota, Dennis of Lake City, and Raymond of Kansas. She leaves behind a legacy of many fond memories to her grandchildren. Todd, spouse Lori Wooters of Minnesota, Amy, spouse Ray Rindall of Minnesota, Chad, spouse Mariah Wooters of Colorado, and Kayla, spouse Fred Klaas, K-L-A-A-S, of Colorado, along with nine great-grandchildren and one great-great-grandchild, and many nieces and nephews. Spending time with family and friends, playing card games, traveling, and attending special events were just some of the ways that she enjoyed her life with all of us. Dolores Gronemeyer, 94, formerly of Gowrie, passed away Friday, November 3, Northeast Community Health Center in Ames. Celebration of Life visitation will be held from 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, December 9, at Palmer Funeral Home in Gowrie. Dolores is survived by her sons, Marshall, spouse Donna Gronemeyer of Scottsville, New York, and Mitchell, spouse Connie Gronemeyer of Ames. Daughters Janon, J-E-N-O-N, spouse Joel Cody of Grand Junction, and Jana Kurth of Mankato, Minnesota. 11 grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Dolores is preceded in death by her husband, Thomas Gronemeyer, parents Harry and Anna, spouse or Anna Dirks Lange, L-A-N-G-E, sister Sherry Malaro, and son-in-law Paul Kurth. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. and Tom Chorley Boelke, B-O-H-L-K-E, Tim Chorley Boelke, 68 of Fort Dodge, passed away Saturday, December 2, at his home. Services are pending with Losweiler Funeral Home. Joseph Cormack, services for Joseph, 49 years old, will be 11 a.m. on Tuesday. That's today. No, I'm sorry. It's on Tuesday, December 5, at the Gunderson Funeral Chapel. Visitation will be 10 to 11 a.m. on Tuesday, GundersonFuneralHome.com. And Charles Clausen. Charles Vernon Clausen, 73, died November 27, his home in Fort Dodge, south of Fort Dodge. Service honoring Charlie's life will be 11 a.m. Friday, December 8, at St. Olaf Lutheran Church with Pastor Jim McCauley officiating. Visitation is 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, December 7, at Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. The service will be live streamed through the St. Olaf Lutheran Church Facebook page. Memorials left in Charlie's name will be donated to charities. Charlie was born August 31, 1950, to Vernon Morris and Ella Dagny Allison Clausen in Fort Dodge. He was raised on a dairy farm south of Gilmore City and graduated from Gilmore City Bradgate High School in 1968. He married Joan Rasmussen on March 17 of 71, and a daughter, Rachel, was born to this union. Charlie married Roselia Buda on December 13, 1997, shared a partnership of deep love and respect. He obtained a bachelor's degree in sociology in 1973 from the University of Northern Iowa in 1973 and was employed that same year as a juvenile court officer for the state of Iowa, where he served for 33 years in 2006. He was a member of St. Olaf Lutheran Church and enlisted for the boards of Youth Shelter Care and Gateway to Discovery. Rest in peace. And finally, Roxy Jacobson, 81, Fort Dodge, passed away Saturday, December 2nd, and services are pending with Losweiler Funeral Home. So we're ending, soon we're going to be ending our time together here, but here's a little community calendar information. Today, Fort Dodge Noon Rotary, Noon Shiny Top Brewing is at 520 Central Avenue. And today, Fort Dodge Civitan Club, 5:30 p.m., Pizza Ranch, 3311 Fifth Avenue South. Glenn Hedrickson Performance, 6 to 8 p.m. today, St. Paul Lutheran Church, 400 South 13th Street. Bingo at 6:30 p.m., the Opera House, Fort Museum, and Frontier Village, 1 Museum Road. Doors open at 5 p.m., early birds start at 6:30 p.m. Tomorrow, Tuesday, Daybreak Rotary Club, 7 a.m. at Tinton Cafe Boardroom, Iowa Central Community College. The Blandon Memorial Art Museum, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., 923rd Avenue South. Admission is free. This is tomorrow. And Fort Dodge, Noon Kiwanis, Noon Pizza Ranch, 3311 5th Avenue South. And Fort Dodge Evening Lions Club, will be 7 p.m., Pizza Ranch, 3311 5th Avenue South. And for information on AA meetings, go to aa-iowa.org. Here's a little sports information, sports on TV that you might be concerned with. The men's college basketball, Iowa is at Purdue. That'll be 6 p.m. on BTN. Arkansas State at Alabama will be at 7 p.m. on SECN. Women's College Soccer. Stanford versus Florida State at 5 p.m. ESPNU. NBA basketball, if you're interested in that, Boston at Indiana at 6:30 p.m. TNT. Boston at Indiana, 6:30 p.m. on True TV. New Orleans at Sacramento, 9 p.m. on TNT. NFL football. Cincinnati at Jacksonville, 7 p.m. ABC, ESPN, and ESPN2. And local calendar here it has. Event is bowling. Dodgers versus Urbandale at 3 p.m. and girls basketball, Dodgers versus Des Moines Hoover, 6:15 p.m. Won't have time to read the stories, but there's an article here about Purdy, 49ers ground the Eagles in the game. And it's got a picture of Brock Purdy passing the ball. He seems to be doing pretty well. It's got a story here on Iowa headed to Florida. The Hawkeyes are going to face the Vols, Tennessee, in Cheez-It Citrus Bowl. That's the Hawkeyes. And then Iowa State, they're going to meet Memphis in the Liberty Bowl. They've been there before. It says Cyclones will travel to Memphis for the Liberty Bowl. And that will be, Cyclones are 7-5 versus Memphis, which is 9-3, December 29th. Memphis, Tennessee is where it'll be. Time will be 2:30 p.m. It'll be televised on ESPN2. And the Iowa Hawkeyes, Cheez-It Citrus Bowl, January 1, Orlando, Florida. And that will be televised at noon on ABC TV. And folks, that brings us to the end of today's December 4 Monday reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. My name is Doug Kretzinger. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, and I hope you have a great day.